For the transcript record, this will be locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings initial report going from 9 a.m. to 10:30 on April 11th, 2013.
For those of you just joining us here in Beijing, feel free to come up and join us at the table. There's plenty of space. We'll be starting in the next couple of minutes. If you're wondering which room you're in, this is the UDRP LOC Working Group. UDRP LOC Working Group will be starting very shortly. Right, good morning everybody. I think we'll start this, get this going. Has the recording been started, Marika? Okay, good morning everybody. It's Michaela Nayland, the chair of the UDRP LOC Working Group. And sitting on my right is Alan Greenberg, my wonderful co-chair. We suppose we should do a quick roll call just to see who's here, and then we will proceed. We are presenting our initial report, and of course what we would love to be able to see after we've gone through the basics is any feedback, any thoughts that you have on this, preferably constructive feedback. If you tell us that you don't like something, please tell us why, And so let's see if we can just do a tour of the tabs to see who is here. So Michaela Nalen, Black Knights.
Alan Greenberg, At Large Advisory Committee.
Philip Corwin of Virtual Law LLC, participating as counsel with the Internet Commerce Association.
Erica Randall, ICANN staff.
Marika Konings, ICANN staff.
Lars Hoffman, ICANN staff.
John Berard from the business constituency. And Barry Cobb from ICANN staff.
And for the record, we also have John Berryhill sitting down the table, ignoring us, but okay. We have apologies from Luc Souffert, who's went to the Trademark Clearinghouse, which is right up against this. I think several of our other regular members have ended up at the other session because it's running straight up against this one. Please, people, there are plenty of space at the table if you'd like to come up. I mean, Elliot, I see Elliot Noss is in the room. Okay, yes, okay. If you want to come up to the table because you want to be closer to participate, or if you want to be honest like Elliot and just leech the power, feel free. Okay, then. So, the UDRP Lock Working Group, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, we'll just go through the slides very, very quickly and then open it up, hopefully, for some feedback from the rest of you. Do we have anybody on the phone bridge, Marika, at this juncture?
This is Marika. I don't think we have anyone on the phone bridge, but we do have several people listening in through the Adobe Connect, amongst which Celia Lehrman, who's also a member of the working group.
Okay, and good morning to those of you who are joining us remotely as well. Excuse me?
Do I have a second?
Of course you can. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I support the work of this group fully, but I have a full overlap conflict right now, and I'll be leaving in about 15 minutes. So it says nothing about the work of this group or Michaela.
If it was about me, he just wouldn't admit it, but we'll work on the basis that he actually has got a full schedule. Okay, then. So we'll present the report, and I'll try to go through these slides quickly. If I'm speaking far too quickly with my charming Irish accent and you can't understand a word I'm saying, please do let me know. Otherwise, I'll assume that you understand me perfectly. Okay, so the GNSO, could have the next slide up there, please. The GNSO Council initiated a PDP limited to the subject of locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings. For those of you who have been around for a while, there was a lot of discussion about reviewing the UDRP. It was decided not to do that at that time. But this part of it was permitted to be reviewed, as it were. So at the current status is there's no requirement to lock names in period between filing complaint and commencement of proceedings. And there is no definition of status quo, which has resulted in different interpretations and confusion. Because if you look at the actual language of the UDRP, it talks about the status quo, which might seem wonderfully clear, but is it? This is ICANN. Nothing's ever clear. Okay, so next slide, please. Okay, so we conducted a survey of the registrars and the UDRP providers. We tried to get an idea of their current practices and what issues they face from both sides. We also had comments from various GNSO stakeholder groups and SOs and ACs. And we published our initial report back on the 15th of March of this year. The initial report contains 11 preliminary recommendations to clarify and standardize the process for locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings. And because that's very long, we just keep saying UDRP lock. Now, most of our recommendations are to codify existing practices in line with the UDRP, and are not expected to require any changes to the existing policy. However, we do want feedback. I mean, ultimately, we don't know everything. We can't know everything. If the wording isn't clear, or you think there's open to some other usage or abuse or whatever, let us know, please. We're not all seeing and all knowing. However, should these recommendations be adopted in the current form, minor changes may be needed to the UDRP rules and or UDRP provider supplemental rules. Next slide. Okay, recommendations. Definition of locking. The term lock means preventing any change of registrar and registrant without impairing the resolution of the domain name. Number two, modify requirement for complainant notify respondent at the timing of filing. UDRP provider will be responsible for notification at official commencement. Number three, following receipt of verification request, the registrar has 2 business days to lock, in inverted commas, the domain name registration. Registrar is not allowed to notify the registrant until the lock, in inverted commas, has been applied. 3b. Any updates as a result of a request by the accredited or affiliated privacy/proxy provider to reveal the underlying proxy customer data need to be made before the 2 business day time frame ends or before the registrar verified the information requested and confirms the lock to the UDRP provider. If information is revealed after the lock has been applied, the UDRP provider is not obliged to request amendment of the complaint, but may do so at its discretion. That's okay. I'm trying to keep up here on my laptop as well. I have the slides in front of me. I'm just swiping things. Sorry, I'm more than happy to go back, Elliot, if you don't mind. There's no problem. I'm happy to. The other thing as well, because a lot of this stuff, it's okay, it's UDRP. I mean, if you're a trademark lawyer, any trademark lawyers here? John, you're a trademark lawyer? Okay. Do you find this stuff terribly exciting?
I mean, it's 90% of what I do for a living, so I find it tremendously exciting.
I'm just from an understand perspective, when you say if information is revealed after the lock has been applied, what would be an example of that?
Okay, maybe somebody else here might want to jump in so it doesn't sound like it's the world according to McKaylee, which you know would be a very perverse world.
John, do you want to answer that then?
No, I mean, I don't mind whichever way. Look, guys, we can try to explain this to you bit by bit, or we can wait till the end. I don't mind, whichever works for you. It's all the same to me, Elliot. Marika, go ahead.
This is Marika. I'll try to explain and have anyone else jump in if I'm wrong. I think the idea is here that if the registrar is aware that privacy or proxy service is involved, either because it's provided by the registrar or once we have an accreditation program in place, the registrar can reach out to that service, but first needs to preliminary lock the domain. So at that point, they don't confirm yet to the UDRP provider that it has been locked, but it gives them an opportunity to actually talk to the proxy privacy service to determine whether they want to reveal the data, give them an opportunity to do so, but within the 2 business days. And at the moment that happens, at that moment, a change can be made, noting that they need to make sure that they're dealing with affiliated party or an accredited privacy proxy service. They may make that change then or that update, but it needs to be matching the underlying customer data. And at that point, they lock the domain again and confirm to the UDRP provider or verify the information and confirm that the lock has been applied. I think that's...
I want to stick to understand, forget about comments, agree, disagree, like, dislike. So you're saying here that if there's a UDRP brought and there is privacy in place and the privacy provider, whether registrar or otherwise, decides to reveal the data, that the UDRP provider is then at their complete discretion as to whether to amend the complaint or not. That's what I'm just asking. That's what I think that says.
No, I think there may be confusion, and I have to say we did abbreviate the actual recommendation to fit it on the slide. The idea is either there is a reveal done prior to the registrar confirming to the log to the UDRP provider, and it's at that stage more at the discretion of the registrar, because as there's no accreditation program in place, we're basically saying it's up to the registrar to make that determination whether they're dealing with a legitimate privacy proxy service and allow that change. But if that doesn't happen before the 2 business days or before the registrar confirms to the UDRP provider that the log or the data that is in there and the log has been confirmed, after that, it's really up to the UDRP provider or to the panel. Because basically, as I understand from, I don't think we have any UDRP providers in the room, but I do see Christine is on the chat, and I hope she will tell us if I'm wrong. But as I understand, at the moment, it's really at the discretion of the panel. If after the log has having been applied, the UDRP provider is informed that there are changes to the registrant information because of a privacy proxy service being involved, it's really up to the panel to decide whether they use the underlying registrant data as the respondent or the privacy proxy service or both. And I think both examples have been used, and it's really at the discretion of the panel.
So implied in that is if the privacy provider does reveal the data prior to the lock, then the UDRP provider is required to change the complaint.
Yes, but at that point, the proceedings haven't commenced yet, and I'm glad that David is walking into the room. So maybe you can restate your question, because I think the UDRP providers have a clear idea. My understanding is indeed that the UDRP provider would amend the complaint if the registrar indeed confirms upon the moment of verification that this is actually the underlying registrant information that needs to be in the complaint, and they would update the complaint accordingly. So, but you may want to restate it for David to confirm that.
I think I understand your answer.
Okay.
I think we need to try and get through as much of this as possible, because I don't want us to get bogged down in one. Good morning, by the way. Elliot, is that a bit clearer for you? Okay, fine. I mean, ultimately, just to clarify a little bit, I mean, it's clear. Okay. Okay, perfect. Right, so we'll move on. Next slide, please. Yes. Okay. It was a shiny object. Okay, then. So, registrar must confirm receipt of verification request and confirm the lock within 2 business days. Number 5. If deemed compliant, UDRP provider will forward the complaint to the registrar and respondent and notify the commencement no later than 3 business days following receipt of the fees paid by the complainant. Number 6. Should the complaint remain non-compliant or be withdrawn, the UDRP provider informs the registrar, who will remove the lock, again within inverted commas, within 1 business day. Next slide. Number 7. The UDRP provider informs the registrant that any corrections to the registrant's contact information during the remaining pendency of the proceedings are also required to be communicated to the UDRP provider. Number 8. The notifications, as per recommendation number 7, would also include information that any changes as a result of a lifting of a proxy/privacy service following the locking would need to be discussed/addressed by the UDRP panel directly. Next slide. Okay. Number 9. Upon receipt of a decision, the registrar must, within 3 business days, communicate to each party, the provider and ICANN, the date for the implementation of the decision. Number 10. In the case of suspension of a proceeding, the UDRP provider informs the registrar of the suspension, including the expected duration of the suspension. Should a settlement be reached, the registrar must remove the lock, between inverted commas, within 2 business days. In relation to handling the settlement, the working group has put forward 2 different options for further input. Are there any slides, Marika? The other 2 options were that in the report. The options for further input, are they on the slides here? Okay, never mind. Number 11, ICANN, in collaboration with UDRP providers, registrars and other interested parties, will develop educational and information materials that will assist in informing affected parties of these new requirements and recommended best practices. And just by note, the working group appears to have consensus for all the recommendations. a formal consensus call, as per ICANN's way of handling consensus, will be conducted once the recommendations are finalized. And of course, if you want the full report, yes, Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, it isn't, Marika. I just noticed indeed that I spelled it out in the notes to the slides, but it's actually not on the on the slides themselves. The two options that are being put out for
further input. And I couldn't see that there because the joys of using a MacBook Air is you kind of end up with not seeing the things halfway down the bottom of the screen. Sorry, just going back to the options here. If the number, going back to that slide, Lars, if you don't mind, and it's the slide with 9 and 10. Okay, sorry. In recommendation 10, the working group has two different options for further input. So, if the complainant has prevailed, the registrar shall implement the panel order immediately after 10 business days have elapsed. The complainant or its authorised representative is required to provide the registrar with the required information regarding the implementation. This may include the information that should be in WHOIS. If the respondent has prevailed, the registrar should prohibit transfer of the domain name to another registrar or registrant for 15 business days. Yes. Oh, God, help. Am I screwing up here completely?
Yeah, that's actually recommendation number 9. The two options are below there on the number 10, option A and B.
Sorry, this is what happens when people have me doing stuff early in the morning. I'm going to actually hand this over to Marika before I screw it up even more.
Okay, so this is Marika. So in the case of a settlement, the working group did discuss quite extensively if a more detailed process would need to be put in place to help guide the different parties involved on what need to happen. And at the moment, there are actually the two options that they have outlined and would like community input on, or you know, if there are other options that should be considered, they of course would welcome that as well. So the option A, basically step-by-step process, would be that point one, parties ask for suspension, the two parties settle, three, parties inform provider, four, the provider issues an order to the registrar to change the holder details or delete the domain name, five, that change or deletion happens, and six, the complainant confirms the change or deletion is complete, and seven, at that time, the provider dismisses the case. Or option B, which is number one, the parties ask for suspension, and the suspension request includes the automatic dismissal when the suspension period is up. Two, the provider issues order allowing registrar to unlock for the sole purpose of whatever the settlement is. Two, the parties settle. Three, parties request the registrar to unlock, not to manage anything further like terms, just unlock to allow transfer. And four, provider dismisses case automatically with no further action needed. If the settlement discussions break down, either party can request that the case be reinstated before automatic dismissal. As I understand, I think option B is the current practice that happens, if I'm not mistaken. And I think option A is actually something I think that gets special support from the registrars, where they would like to see the UDRP providers actually taking on the role of directing registrars on what settlement has been reached between the two parties, and instead of the registrars having to try to make that determination on whether they're dealing with the authorized parties and trying to interpret what has been reached. So I think those are the two options that are currently on the table. And again, specific input is sought on those, or if there are other alternatives that should be considered, that's welcome too.
Thank you, Marika. You're far more with it this morning than I am. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Michele, and Marika as well. This is David Roach-Turner from WIPO. I just have two comments. The first is on the language of the recommendations, and the second is on option B, which Marika just outlined, and the comment for both is similar, and that is just to mention that in recommendation 10, at the end of the first sentence, which I'm reading on the screen, it reads, the registrar must remove the lock within 2 business days. And obviously, that obligation would apply only for the purposes of the UDRP proceeding itself. It may be worth clarifying that. And the reason I make the point is that there are other reasons why a domain name may be required to be locked, for example, a court order. And so we would not want to oblige the registrar to take a step that would be precluded by another judicial order or anything of that nature. The other is just concerning option B, which includes a component under which the provider orders or authorises the registrar to unlock the domain name solely for the purposes of giving effect to the or a settlement agreement between the parties, and the same comment there would apply. The provider could only give that authorisation for the purposes of the UDRP proceeding itself. Obviously, it would not override any instruction that might be applicable pursuant to a court order or a similar judicial instruction.
Thank you. Elliot, go ahead.
Right on this point, you know, David, you use the language court order. You know, I'm wondering how you feel about, and I'd like to put out, that you know, I think that's if a court proceeding has commenced as opposed to an order has been issued. So first let me just check with you, David, whether you would agree with that statement. Our practice, and I believe the practice in the industry, is that if a court proceeding has been commenced, we lock the name. Because actually, otherwise you would have a situation where, you know, you could have the UDRP that's now stayed, but you're, you know, you might have a 2 or 3 year window between an order being commenced and a court order being issued where, you know, according to this language, the name would be unlocked.
And if I could just sort of clarify one thing that you mentioned there, Elliot, is that, I mean, that's in the UDRP, actually. The UDRP, there's this unfortunate tendency to focus on the what's called an administrative proceeding under the UDRP, which is one part of it, the UDRP. But if you get into paragraph 8 of the UDRP, it says that you know, if there's a court proceeding, the name is to be locked, and that has, you know, utterly nothing to do with you know, any of the UDRP providers or the administrative or the conduct of the administrative proceeding.
And the language of these recommendations should be consistent with that.
Well, yeah, but nobody ever reads the rest of the UDRP.
I'm pushing for consistency in that, and I'm wondering if you would agree with that.
Yeah, this is David. I think the language that I just suggested would help to address that concern, because it would limit the ambit of any instructions issued by the provider to the application to the UDRP only. So it would not preclude the maintenance of a lock for purposes of the filing of a court dispute, if that would be the registrar's practice consistent with the UDRP.
What I feel that does, and I'm going to come to I'm going to go a little deeper on a related point soon, but what I feel that does is it instructs courts around the world about the way that the UDRP process handles these things. Sadly, because these rules were developed in 99 and there's no capacity for changing them, courts around the world are forced to interpret them. And what happens then is any of the parties to litigation get, you know, have a much greater occurrence of time and costs, you know, as they're trying to educate courts in all of these jurisdictions around the world as to what we all meant. So I think clarity here is deeply important. So, I mean, I think if you agree that, you know, that that is the case, that if there is a court proceeding commenced, then we would be really well served in terms of providing, you know, using this as a means of helping for adjudication of domain name disputes around the world, to be clear in our language and be express about that.
If this is David, if I'm understanding the implication of what you're saying correctly, and that clarity on this point could be useful, and you would be proposing as a way forward to address that issue that there also be some language included in the recommendations to indicate that a registrar could maintain a lock that it had applied resulting from the filing of court proceedings, then perhaps that would be a useful clarification.
Just a minor adjustment there. You said could, and I'm going to say will or should. You know, it's not about discretion. You know, we as registrars want to be effecting what the panel and what the courts decide. We don't want to be interpreting. And right now, there is a huge gray area, again, because of some anachronisms around exactly this point.
I suppose this is David again. I mean, I suppose the situation may vary depending on the terms of any particular order that would be issued by a court.
Sorry, I'm not talking about order, because that's at the end of the process. I'm talking about the commencement of a process.
Right, and I guess the questions that come up with respect to the commencement of a process can then include, for example, is this a proceeding, a court proceeding that has been commenced specifically with respect to the domain name, or is it a court proceeding that has been commenced in respect of which the domain name is a relevant asset? Is it a court proceeding that concerns receivership or some other scope of assets that goes well beyond the domain name under dispute in the UDRP instance? I think there's a lot of variation there.
There is, but let's not get greedy. Let's deal with the simple case where the court proceeding is dealing with the domain name directly. I agree with you. There are other situations as well. But, for us, the clear practice, both in our business and with the other major registrars and those that have to deal with this, is to lock around the commencement of a proceeding. We think that's what we should be doing. I would imagine that you would agree that that's what we should be doing. And what we don't, what happens now is there's a gray area. And you have courts trying to interpret this. And they look at the fact that there's a gray area here, as meaning that they have to try and infer from what we're all doing here. I want to be express about it.
Okay, guys, just bringing this in a little bit. From what I can gather, don't give me to who looks like that, Alex. If we're you're getting into a kind of a court judicial... A judicial area, not specifically UDRP, or am I misunderstanding?
You are misunderstanding.
Okay.
Kaylee, think about it like this.
Okay.
Imagine that you have a situation where a UDRP has been commenced, all of this has gone on, a court proceeding has been initiated in response to that proceeding being commenced. Okay? Now, because of that, there's been a suspension or a withdrawal. According to this language, it's now your discretion as to whether you should maintain that lock because of the court proceeding. John made reference to the fact that elsewhere in the rules there is a description of that. But what I would say to you is, because this is dealing with exactly this point, if we're not express about that in this proceeding, then what will happen is parties will argue about it, and courts around the world will be forced to interpret it. It's a very simple point. I'm not being,
understand.
I think it's one that we should be, deeply lined up around.
But right? What language are you suggesting, Elliot? That's what I'm trying to understand.
That it's not court order, as David said, and I agree it should be order, but that it should be that a court proceeding has been commenced.
Okay.
This is David again. From a provider perspective, I suppose our principal focus here is on ensuring that there is a mechanism for getting the domain name locked for purposes of the UDRP and getting it unlocked at the end of the UDRP. And then what happens with respect to the domain name in any subsequent court proceeding is an issue that obviously needs to be considered.
But I think Elliot's point is that the court order, court stuff may happen at the same time. It doesn't have to be afterwards. Is that correct?
Well, in fact, the filing of a UDRP will regularly lead to a court proceeding being commenced.
Well, my suggestion was to reduce it to a suggestion at the level of language to see if it's helpful. Is if we would make a modification to recommendation 10 and to option B that we were just discussing. We could say, for example, that the registrar must remove the lock within 2 business days for purposes of the UDRP dispute, unless the disputed domain name is, otherwise the subject of a court proceeding that has been commenced concerning that disputed domain name.
And perfect. That's exactly what I'm encouraging. That's great.
I don't think we would have any problem with that awesome. From a provider perspective.
Phil, please. Mr. Corwin.
If was that subject exhausted? I don't want to interrupt it, but I'd like to, Mikhail, I'd like to just get in a bit of a dialogue with you and then discuss another.
Well, it's not with me alone, Phil. I'm just trying to chair the circus.
Staff, I just want to start by clarifying. Current UDRP practice, if I'm correct, is that the complainant is required to notify the registrant upon filing of the... Well, you recommend specifically in the report that the complainant no longer be required to notify the registrant upon the filing of a complaint.
I'll leave that to somebody else to
This is Marika. Yes, that is correct. So it is still allowed, but it's no longer required as it currently is under the rules.
Okay. And that is based, as I understand it, on concerns about reported incidents of cyberflight. That is where bad actor registrants, upon receiving that notice, but before the registrar has received official notice from the arbitration provider, so they can move the domain and avoid the action, so-called cyberflight. But as I understand, that is based on anecdotal reports, but there's no actual data as to how often cyberflight occurs. Is that correct?
This is Rick. I would actually look to the UDRP providers to confirm if they have any data on that. I mean,
Was there any hard data on which that recommendation was made, or it was simply based on anecdotal reports of cyberflight incidents?
This is Rick. It's as well on an assessment at, you know, what time gap do you have between the lock being applied and an opportunity for transfers out? And that was one of the obvious gaps that was identified, where the registrar is not notified yet, or probably hasn't been notified by the UDRP provider yet, but the respondent has. So there is an obvious, or at least a group determined, I believe, that there's an obvious gap there between the fact that the registrar cannot do anything yet to prevent any changes, or doesn't see that there may be any changes that are being made to the name that, as a result, mean that the domain name is gone and cannot be found anymore as such, or no longer subject to the UDRP proceeding. So that's why they found that as a mechanism to say, okay, if we take that obligation at least out, which doesn't mean that the complainant can still do so, that may take away that risk and basically notify the complainant at the same time, or at the moment that the lock is actually, the respondent, when the lock is actually in place.
Okay. Well, that, based on that background, I just want to express a concern here, and I intend to file a formal comment letter addressing this and probably some other subjects in the report. The concern is that right now there's somewhat of a disparity between the complainant and registrant, and that the complainant has all the time in the world to draft the complaint. They determine the timing of the filing of the complaint. They can file it on Christmas Eve. They can file it on August 1st against a European registrant when everyone's off on holiday, etc. They determine which arbitration provider, which forum they're going to seek arbitration is. And right now, the period which can often exceed a week or more between the time that the registrant receives the notice now from the complainant and the time they receive the official notice from the provider, I can tell you, you know, in my role as counsel to a law firm in Washington, registrants who aren't involved a lot with ICANN or with the domain name industry, who just have a domain name, receiving a UDRP notice is a fairly traumatic experience. And right now, when they get that notice from the complainant, they're a little freaked out, and they don't understand what UDRP is. Then they understand that they can lose their domain, and they use that period now between receipt of the notice from the complainant and the official notice from the provider to understand the proceeding and secure counsel and begin to think about whether they're going to respond, what the response should be, so that the practical effect of this for a lot of registrants is to take away a week or more of preparatory time to respond to a complaint that the complainant has had a great deal of time to prepare and has had all the control of the timing and the provider. So I think in no way am I advocating for cyberflight, but I think there has to be some adjustment here so that all that time isn't lost. Perhaps once the lock is imposed, which takes a day or so, then the registrant should receive official notice from the provider or something, so that they don't lose all that time, which they use right now to assert their rights when they believe that the UDRP is mistaken and that they have rights in the name and should not lose it. And again, I'll be following up officially and comment on that.
Okay, thanks. I've got a cue here. Just on the remote there, Christine Dorian saying to Phil, we have submitted some data and have noted the number of hours spent handling cyberflight cases, both the providers and ICANN. And then I have Gabby and Mr. Berryhill.
I just wanted to read the same comment that you just read, so it's okay. Thank you.
No comments of your own?
No, just wanted to comment the Rain's comment.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to clarify a little bit what Phil said with the visual aid that's now up on the screen. That you know, a lot of people who comment on these things and talk about these things, you know, have not been in the trenches and don't see what goes on. What you're looking at on that screen is a UDRP complaint, and I have the WIPO case number on it. It was sent in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 3-inch binders. It weighed over 20 pounds, and that is what we're talking about hiding from the domain registrant in order to minimize the amount of time that they have when they get this UDRP notice of commencement. You know, and the first thing they do, as Phil said, is, you know, well, they go to the lawyer that drafted their mother's will, they go to the lawyer that helped them with the deed to their house, you know, who's never heard of, the first thing that many clients, I have a long-time, very sophisticated client who got a notice from the ADNDRC Seoul, Korea office in a case last week. Even I didn't know that they had opened an office up in Seoul, Korea, because there are also fake UDRP complaint notices that get sent around because all this is conducted by email. And these things go into spam. So, you know, as you can imagine, walking into a general practice law office with something that looks like what we have here on the screen, when, you know, the first question out of the lawyer's mouth is going to be, what is a domain name? This idea of cutting down on the time that someone has to, as Phil said, you know, secure counsel that, you know, even knows what we're talking about here is a little odd. You know, I understand the issue. In fact, I saw the other day some blogger saying, oh, well, if you get a UDRP notice, go ahead and delete the name or something like that. I would say to Phil, there are people that do that. It is an actual, you know, nuisance that occurs. But having put in, once we get a policy in place where the registrar is to lock the name upon communication from the UDRP provider, then there's no reason to wait until, you know, some further step to provide the respondent with the actual complaint. And I'll tell you, if I see domain names being locked and a UDRP provider not being forthcoming with providing me with a copy of the complaint that's been filed against my registrant, and the domain name is locked, is, you know, Christine, I will go to the district court in Minneapolis, and I will, you know, just file an emergency motion to get it out of you if that's where the rule ends up. Thank you.
Thanks, John. There's a couple of comments on the Adobe Connect remote, which I just want to just try to summarize quickly for those of us in the room who may not be looking at it. From Desiree Boxberger of aplus.net, one recommendation that I believe we need to clarify in the definition of lock. There are three layers of lock: registrar, registrant, and registry. Some, but not all, registries allow for locks. However, those locks do not bar changes to the whois, especially in common net. In other words, thin whois. Also, I do like the clarification of barring changes to whois, but allowing resolution of the domain name. Volker, I see you are here. Welcome. Any comments, or are you just looking directly at me?
Well, in the discussions, it was clear that we were talking about a registrar lock, because that's the lock that the registrar is able to place. So maybe we should just clarify this more, but I think it should be clear from the documents that we've prepared.
Okay, thank you. Marika?
This is Marika. One of the things I think the working group did discuss but didn't make a firm recommendation on it at the moment is that I think it does say somewhere that before the lock is applied, the registrar is not supposed to contact the registrant unless it's in the case of a privacy proxy service. But I think we haven't instated a requirement for the registrar to notify the registrant at the moment they lock it. So I don't know if that's something, for example, to address some of the concerns and saying that there's less time, because there may be some time in between, you know, the registrar and confirms to the UDRP provider, and the UDRP provider then transmit the complaint to the respondent. So maybe that may be a mechanism as well to build in more time, where as soon as the registrar locks the domain name, they confirm that to the registrant that it has been locked because a UDRP has been filed and further information will be followed. Also, the requirement to lock within 2 days doesn't mean that the registrar cannot lock before. And I think some registrars have indicated as well that they typically receive a copy of the complaint at the moment of filing by the complainant, and they often already lock at that stage. So again, if there would be a requirement built in that a registrar has to notify the registrant at the moment they lock a domain name once they've received a copy of a complaint, that may be another mechanism to provide a heads-up start, but at the same time have the domain name locked down to prevent any changes, which I think is the main concern or the main reason why the working group has considered, you know, changing that requirement to require the complainant to notify the respondent at the time of filing.
David, go ahead.
This is David. Yeah, just from a WIPO provider perspective, I think that latter proposal that Marika just mentioned is one that would work from our perspective. I think the objective here is to get the domain name locked as early as it can be locked to preclude the risk of cyber flight. It's certainly not intended or designed to minimise the amount of informal time that the respondent has to respond to the complaint. That's not the purpose at all. Just in response to Phil's query, there is also some data that we fed into the deliberative process as part of the earlier discussions in the working group, providing some case studies on the issue of cyberflight. So if you wanted some information to feed into your submission process, it should be there in the record from our side as well. But the other option, of course, which I think received some discussion as well, is the idea of further reducing the period of time that the registrar might have to put in place the lock after a request would be received. But the difficulty with that approach, obviously, is that it runs into real-world considerations about when you can realistically lock in light of weekends and public holidays, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the proposal that we see in the recommendation, I think, was intended to be a bit of a compromise between the two concerns. So it enables the risk of cyber flight, which is indeed where it results a very complicated issue to have to resolve, to be managed.
Thanks. I mean, Phil, just making sure, okay. I mean, the thing from our perspective, just so we're clear, I mean, for those of us involved in this, we're trying to make it clearer, more predictable, less open to individual interpretation. Or put very simply, you shouldn't need to have a massive legal team as a registrar to be able to know what the hell you're meant to do when there's a UDRP. I mean, that's, you know, simplifying it right down. If any of you have issues with our recommendations, if it's not clear to you why we made the recommendation, please understand it's not that we're trying to make life miserable for anybody. We're trying to make things easier to deal with. Now, that doesn't mean we got it right. We could have made a complete mess of it. And if we did, well, we're sorry, but please give us input and feedback. Go ahead, Phil.
Just to respond quickly, to make clear, my concern is in no way do I wish to be, you know, seen as defending cyberflight or folks who are trying to avoid adjudication when there's an accusation of infringement. That's not proper if they think they have that the complaint is unfounded and without sufficient merit, they should participate. My concern is that for many, many, you know, we live in ICANN world and we know all this stuff and all the acronyms, and I just had a case where the folks who manage my IT services, you know, my web page and things, one of the senior staff was listed as administrative contact on a domain name that got caught up in a bankruptcy court proceeding, and suddenly he's the object of UDRP. And there was some fame to the domain, so he's being named in a domain industry blog as a potential cyber squatter. And he's freaked out and trying to understand, way before he's received the official complaint from WIPO, what is this and what do I do about it and what do I tell my customer who I've been listed as administrative contact. It's a pretty, for folks who are not in this business, being on the receiving end of a UDRP is a traumatic experience and one that they require some time if they believe, if the complaint, if there's a real issue in the case, it's not black and white, they need it takes time to find learned counsel like Mr. Berry, who understands how to deal with this type of thing. And we don't want to in any way enable or encourage cyberflight. We want to make sure that registrants have sufficient time and don't have this week to 10 days they now enjoy before they get the official notice taken away, because that's a very important time period for the average registrant to understand what their rights are and what options are available and to find competent counsel to help them respond.
Thanks, Phil. And just for the record, Phil and I had actually had this chat rather informally very late at night. There was alcohol involved, so I asked Phil to come in and give it this to us when we were all a lot more sober. The gentleman at the microphone...
I have no recollection of that conversation.
Exactly. The gentleman at the mic, and then Elliot.
And the gentleman is Peter Rimfort, in this case representing FICB. And I'm sorry for this question because I just arrived, so I missed the first 10 minutes, and you have or may have already been perfectly clear with that. But just a practical question. When you talk about 3 business days, is it the country of the registrar, or what is it? I mean, business days and holidays is not exactly the same all over the world.
Okay, hold on a second. John, Marika, I'll let John go. John.
The UDRP is a contract provision. The contract is between the registrar and the registrant. The contract sets a venue. The contract sets this contract is valid under the law. If I register a domain name with 2 cals, it says this contract is to be interpreted under the laws of Canada. So to the extent that that contract refers to business days, and I have made that contract with 2 cals, then we would be looking at business days in Canada, because this is a creature of a contract that has a legal situs.
Is that okay? Okay, thank you. Marika, and then I'm going to sneak to... Are you going to do the remote thing?
No. Because I can't read it anymore on my screen because it's over there. So if you can read Christine's comment before, because I saw it passing by. But on the business days, because we did include a footnote on that in the report where we basically say, and I think it is in line with what John was saying, that business days are defined as business days in the jurisdiction of the entity required to undertake the action. So in this case, the registrar.
So, for example, if you're taking action against one of the domains with us, you'd have to bear in mind that we would consider the 17th of March to be a holiday. And before I go taking back the queue, I just wanted to try and get some input, the stuff from remote, before it goes off the screen completely. So Christine Dorian was making a couple of comments, and so was Desiree, and hold on a second. Can somebody try and grab that, because I'm having problems here. There's some discussion on the remote about registry level locks, registrar level locks, registrant level locks, and the general thing here is that we in our discussions nobody really raised the issue of registry locks. I suspect this might be because it hasn't really been an issue, but. You know, this is something somebody was asking. So, John, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, the registry has no involvement, no touch point, no contact with the UDRP. The UDRP operates in a manner that's not even visible to the registry. It is a term of the registrar contract, and there's no point in the UDRP process cycle where the registry is involved in any way, so it would be an entirely new thing to take this out. I agree, though, that is the simple solution, would be to have a mechanism with the registry to at least keep the domain name at the same registrar, because then, you know, it's not going anywhere and it's not getting deleted, so any order bearing on that registrar would be effective. But the the way that the UDRP was structured, and it was a creature of, you know, something of the way that, that ICANN itself was structured, but in a manner to somewhat isolate the registries from, you know, involvement in a number of things that it would be convenient to have them involved in.
Thanks, John. Marika, did you want to? No, okay. Just from the remote, and I'll come to you, David. Christine, I managed to scroll back up. To Phil, would it be helpful if the working group provided a best practices document with information for the registrars to send their client when they lock the domain? Does anyone think registrars would like that?
Well, I'm not representing any registrars officially for this conversation, and I just heard the question, so it's based on about 12 seconds of consideration, but it sounds like something worth considering, a standard. Just like there's now a draft of a standard registrant rights and responsibilities document that will be linked to by all registrars' web pages, it might be worthwhile to look into developing a standard disclosure agreement that all registrars are required to send to a registrant upon when they receive notice that a UDRP has been initiated. It would seem that it would assist particularly the unsophisticated registrant in understanding what's going on and what their rights are and how they might best proceed, and that it might be a good idea to secure a competent counsel, as well as what the basic rules are when the official time to respond begins running, things like that.
Okay, thank you. David, and then I think I might have Elliot. No? Okay, no, sorry, Elliot's just fidgeting.
Yeah, there's been a very recent change in the approach of some panelists around court orders being filed. Court proceedings being commenced. Typically, UDRP panels, when court proceedings were commenced, would defer to those court proceedings, except in extreme circumstances. And, in extreme circumstances were defined in Working Group A in 1999 as things like a registrant using some remote jurisdiction to kind of forum shop to try and avoid the UDRP proceeding. Since the commencement, you know, panelists have respected that. Very recently, panelists, at least in a couple situations, have actually started to issue decisions in the face of court proceedings being commenced. So it's a very a recent and troubling change in practice. And then that has the effect of, again, muddying the a role of the registrar and, of course, of the registrant, meaning, you know, you could have a situation where a UDRP panel has issued a decision, but a court proceeding has been commenced. Now, the challenge is that the at the creation of the policy was clear on what would happen if a court proceeding was commenced prior to a UDRP being commenced, or if a UDRP was, or sorry, if a court proceeding was commenced in response to a UDRP decision. But the policy, while it's at least to me very obvious and clear what the policy intended, the policy is silent on the situation where a UDRP proceeding was commenced, a court proceeding was commenced in response to that, and a UDRP decision has been issued. So now again we have a situation where courts are forced to interpret what we as the ICANN community want and intend from them. And what they end up doing, again, in this situation, is trying to triangulate from old working group papers, because we don't have a good set of rules, we don't have a contract with UDRP providers, and we have no means of amending the practices, because this is really just a, this is implementation, not policy, the situation where I'm talking about. So I'm wondering if we have an opportunity in this PDP to address this issue and close this gap. I don't think the panelists I don't think the UDRP providers want to have this gray area. I think they want it. They would probably prefer it to be defined. But right now, again, it's a gray area, and it makes it very difficult for registrants, for registrars, and for courts. So I don't know if that was clear, David, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Just one thing, guys, as I've got, so we've got some people here in the audience who want to give us some feedback, and David and Elliot as well. I mean, no offense, but I hope you understand, I want to get as much feedback from as wide as possible. So, David, if you'd like to come back on Elliot, and then we're going to go to this gentleman here, okay?
I'm sorry, Michele, I agree, but, you know, look, we've had a lot of, this is a very specific, very important issue that I don't should run to ground, and then no, I don't mind moving on, and I don't mind ceding my place in the queue for the rest of the discussion, Elliot, but I don't want to cut this short.
I'm not trying to cut this short, I'm just trying to make sure that we get as many people in as possible, that's
then let's
all.
Let's do both.
Two quick comments, one on Elliot's point and one on the earlier discussion about the role of the registry in the lock process. I think the relationship between the UDRP and court proceedings is an important question, and I think it's one that obviously needs to be discussed. I'm not sure if it's the sort of discussion that necessarily should take place in this working group, given the mandate that we've been set. I think the place for it to occur may be in the subsequent discussion about the UDRP mechanism writ large, which we're told by ICANN is going to follow this fairly limited technical discussion about the lock procedure. Is just my view, but the issue of the registry...
Sorry, David, I'm going to run this issue to ground first. Look, the intellectual property community... John, as a registrar, I'm dealing with a situation that I don't know what to do with. If you'd like to advise me as to what to do and pick up the liability around that, I'm okay with that. But right now, I carry it.
It's out of scope. That's all.
Thank you for your opinion. David, the intellectual property community broadly opposed looking at UDRP reform in the last go-round. And now I hear you saying, well, we might do it down the road. We have a hole today that complainants are taking advantage of, and sadly that panelists issuing decisions from your arbitration forum in the face of both the Working Group A papers and years of practice has created a very expensive and very risky gray area for registrants and registrars. We could deal with it well within the context of locking here, right in this PDP, despite John's opinion, by simply identifying that where a court proceeding has been commenced, the registrar should respect that proceeding at a level superior to whatever happens, and again, that's proceeding, not order, which I think is clear in the Working Group A papers. If the registrar should respect that the court proceeding that's been commenced, despite any decision that a panelist might have rendered, especially in a situation where a complainant hasn't even filed a response because they've relied on 12 years of practice and instead gone to court.
This is David, just briefly. I'm not sure that it's for a UDRP provider to advise a registrar about what its obligations pursuant to commenced court proceedings or court orders would be, but I think that the language that you've just suggested, Elliot, is probably fairly consistent with the language that I just proposed when we were discussing the earlier recommendations.
Except it could exist again in that second place in this set of recommendations. And maybe what I'll do is I'll be more specific about where we could be explicit about this in two or three places in the recommendations. But I'm really pleased to hear that, you know, you agree that that clarity would be, you know, both consistent with what we're all trying to do, which is, you know, protect rights in a balanced way, and to, you know, make sure that we kind of have clarity for all participants. So that's great.
This is David. In my view, personal view, it makes sense, I think, to make clear that the discussion we're having is about the operation of the UDRP, and that any instructions or recommendations that would be made would be subject to any obligations that the registrar would be under pursuant to commenced court proceedings or to any court order that would be issued.
I think that's great. Thank you.
I just want to make a quick comment, if I could, on the issue of the lock and the role of the registry. I just want to mention, and there's been some discussion of this earlier in our deliberations, that the way that that it operates under the URS, the Uniform Rapid Suspension System, which is intended to be a complementary rights protection mechanism, is that it's the registry that imposes the lock, and the registry imposes that lock within 24 hours of the receipt of the notice from the relevant provider. I think there is some value in seeing if there are ways that we can align the operation of those two mechanisms, because they're both rights protection mechanisms and they both serve broadly the same purpose. They're both going to have compliance obligations for all stakeholders in both processes, and so there is value in trying to look at ways to align them where we can, in my view. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, David. And just on the URS thing, just couple of one thing, we had looked at this, I think, in our deliberations previously and had decided that, well, it was going to be a bit awkward to even consider this because, well, the difference thick and thin, but it was out of scope for what we were looking at. I mean, this is one of the other problems we've been having, is that some of these conversations, whilst valid, the scope we had within this working group was very, very narrowly chartered. Now, I have this gentleman here to my right, and then the Stephanie sitting down there in the queue. There's a few couple of people commenting things remotely, and hopefully we can capture those somehow.
Yeah. Hello, everybody. I just came in late, and I was at another meeting, but this is really my yes, for the record, my name is Jens Peter Jensen, and I'm the CEO of Tiny Registry in Iceland for the .is. The thing is that domain dispute is on the registry level by us. And I understand the gentleman from Tucows, and because we've been in his shoes, so to say. And as a registry, we don't want to decide anything. We want to do, but we don't want to decide. We want the court to tell us what to do, and it has to be precise. And so we involved our own dispute procedure within ESNIC, and I don't know, I'll be as brief as possible, but I just want to tell you that we have implemented it in our web service, where the registrant appeals for a dispute lock. He has to log in, and when we were designing the system, we wanted the registrant to be the person that does the most of the things. We don't want to decide for him, and we hardly want to touch the whole process. So he logs in on his username. He enters the dispute lock application, and then he has to file in the forms, and he has to put in if I just read for you Article 27, ESNIC considers locking requests if accompanied by verification that the case has been brought to a resolution by, and then number one, Icelandic courts, the Icelandic Consumer Agency, which is very strong in this matter, ESNIC Board of Appeals, which we don't run anymore because the Consumer Agency does all the disputes now, or any other party formally qualified to issue a legally binding verdict in this case. Now, here comes the point what I wanted to say, and that's why I agree with the gentleman from Tucows. The verdict has, and ESNIC as a registry has been helping the lawyers, and someone was talking about lawyers that only does wills for the mother and so on. That's also the case in Iceland. So we have been schooling our lawyers and our courts to have the verdicts as accurate as possible and tell who should do what. And only if the verdict tells Eastnick as a registry to transfer a domain, we will do it if the verdict is toward Eastnick. But most of the cases, the verdict is towards the registrant. And this is the main point. The registrant has to log himself into the system on our website, and he has to transfer the domain himself. We as a registry, we don't want to touch it. They are both our customers. And we look actually at the domain self as a customer. Because a domain that has been disputed is always going to be at the registry. I don't know if you get what I mean. So the registrant has to transfer the domain. If he doesn't, if he says, no, I'm not going to transfer the domain to a fellow that I'm competing with in the business, then there is a possibility of deleting the domain. If he deletes the domain and there is only one counterparty, the counterparty becomes the domain automatically through the system. Case solved. If he doesn't delete the domain and doesn't transfer the domain, and the verdict is towards him as a person, as a registrant, the at least the consumer agency in Iceland, they'll put a fine on him. And it's 500, it's half a million krona, I don't know what it is in dollars. But it's a pretty heavy fine if he doesn't transfer the domain. So the registry, as a third party, doesn't do anything else as providing the system to do this, the platform. This is it.
Okay, thank you. And I'm just going to give you a card if you want to email me the link to that. Stephanie. You cannot blame me for everything, Stephanie, much as you might wish to. I'm sorry, it's not me.
Thank you. My name's Stephanie Perrin, and I'm on the expert working group, which, of course, Michaeli is also on with respect to the new directory services. I think my thinking is very much in keeping with my colleague from Iceland, so I'll try to be brief. I was following up on the point that Elliot had made that you don't have clear policy guidelines and that courts are forced to interpret. And I understand that the scope may be limited in terms of the remit of this group, but I'm, as a newcomer to ICANN, I'm very curious as to how you do implementation at the ground level without clear policy guidance. It strikes me as very risky if you're hoping to actually, may I use the word harmonize in a global sense as to what the rules are, the sooner you get the policy guidance out there, the better it's going to be before courts have years and years of precedents that they've worked out on their own. So my question is, how do you, given your scope's limited and you're supposed to be implementing, how do you raise the policy issues that seem to be glaring falling out of this?
Thanks, Stephanie. Actually, Elliot, go ahead.
Yeah, Stephanie, there's been a lot of to and fro around whether there should be UDRP reform, whether there should be providers. You know, there is, from my perspective, too much resistance from particularly the IP community, who I would really urge to see this as an opportunity to create clarity as opposed to, you know, a threat to the great progress we've all already made. And, you know, I would use this forum to say, hey, let's all work together to just get a cleaner, better operating system. I was thrilled to hear David say that ICANN has indicated to him that, you know, that's something that we're all going to be tackling very soon. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, it's the sort of the on-the-ground implementation pieces like this, you know, the flag that, you know, we all have this bigger opportunity, and it'll be a great one to work together to, you know, to really sort of make all of this more effective.
I have Marika, and I also have this lady beside Stephanie, and Phil, and David. So,
Yeah, this is Marika. This is in relation to, in response to, you know, when are we going to review what has happened, and as well the comments David made, because maybe some history lessons for those that weren't involved before, because we did actually have an issue report on a review of the state of the UDRP. Basically, that was extensively discussed. A lot of issues have been identified as part of that issue report. But at that time, it was decided by the Genius Hill Council that they didn't want to embark on a full review of the UDRP, but only focus on this specific issue for now and actually wait with the overall review of the UDRP together with all the other RPMs that have been put in place for the new GTLDs. So I don't remember exactly what the timeline for that is, but basically that review will start, I believe, 1 year after, I think, the delegation of the first GTLD. So that has already been put in place as a means of saying, let's not only look at the UDRP, but in context of all the other mechanisms, so there can be an overall review of everything in place and make sure that everything fits nicely together. I think that was the thinking at the time, at least.
Thanks, Marika. The lady beside Stephanie.
Hello, my name is Luja Chen. I work for the .ae Domain Administration. Now we have the .ae DRP. Basically, it's based on the UDRP. I just wanted to make a comment, basically, to perhaps assist with the situation here, and just wanted to let you know that the .ae DRP has worked fairly extremely well. We don't actually have any issues in respect to cyberflight. We have actually never had an incident of cyberflight. And in addition to Ali's comment, about the effect of court proceedings in relation to the UDRP, I'd just like to say this. We have released in 2003 a clarification on that, and it's very similar to the UDRP in relation to that, and it just basically says that if the registrar has received within 10 days period official documentation that the registrant has commenced legal action against the complainant, then the registrar must take no further action until the legal action is resolved.
Quick question on that. I want to make sure I heard you right. I think you said if a court proceeding has been commenced in response to the ADRP being commenced.
Yes, that's right.
As opposed to in response. See, and the problem is the UDRP language is ambiguous. It says, it clearly says, in response to a UDRP decision, but it doesn't say what happens if a UDRP has been, and this is a gray area that sadly some in practice have taken advantage of now, and sadly in a couple narrow circumstances, and I know you're just you can't have perfect uniformity around your panelists, so I sympathize with you on this, but if there's a situation where a UDRP has been commenced, a court proceeding has been commenced, and a panelist has chosen to issue a decision. Well, now the court proceeding has been commenced in response to the UDRP being commenced, not in response to the decision. And so that is just a gray area. It's not one that was intended, because nobody expected there to be that crazy set of circumstances, either in Working Group A, or in the way the panelists would render decisions. And so, sadly, there's ambiguity. And then where there's ambiguity, lawyers love to take advantage of it, and so they do. So, your language sounds a lot clearer. I would really appreciate if you would submit that as a comment to this PDP, because that would be fantastic.
Okay.
If you want to, there's a couple of ways you can send feedback to us. I mean, there's a comment period open. Or if it's easier for you and you just want to send us a link or a document or whatever, either grab me or I'm going to volunteer Marika, because she's Marika. Just grab any one of us and please, do share this stuff. We want to make things better. Now, I've seen a couple of hands going up, and I'm conscious that we have about 7 minutes until we have to evacuate this room. So, Mr. Corwin... David. Phil, go ahead.
Well,
okay, David, I'll let you go first. Go on.
Just very quickly, I just wanted to clarify for the record, this is David, that I don't have any personal insight additional to the information that we just heard from Marika about the UDRP revision process that we envisage. But of course, the UDRP does intentionally preserve the right of registrants to take a matter to court in the event of a filed UDRP action or in the event of an issued UDRP decision.
I'll give you circumstance where panelists have ignored that, what you call clarity, and I think that's great.
I didn't call it clarity. I just said that the UDRP preserves the right of the registrant to take a matter to court, and it's designed to do that. And I just want to also clarify that the UDRP also reserves to the panel discretion to either issue a decision in the event of commenced court actions or to proceed to issue a UDRP decision that is then not binding in the event that there would be any subsequent court action.
But that again, then I don't think you've heard me. There's two things. One is that the discretion, which I don't question, was very narrowly created to deal with, and it's expressed in the working papers, to deal with situations where a respondent is forum shopping, goes and commences an action in some remote jurisdiction for the purpose of avoiding the decision. So that's first of all. Second of all, you talked about a court proceeding in response to a UDRP decision. The problem is, again, so I'm clear, where a UDRP has been commenced, a court proceeding has been commenced in response to that, and then a panelist issued a decision. Just at a very technical level, that court proceeding has now not been commenced in response to a decision, but in response to a commencement. And it's that gray area, again, that ambiguity. I won't even call it gray area, because I think that the intent of the policy and the practice has been clear. But it's that ambiguity that some have now taken advantage of. So all I'm looking for, again, is for all of us, we have a more effective process where that ambiguity doesn't exist. Language like that ADRP language, which I think you'd be very supportive of at a practical level, would clean all of this up.
And this is David again, and just the third suggestion, and I do hear you, Elliot, I understand what you mean by this, but it may be also that there could be scope for considering the type of precedent that the AUDRP has in place, and which incidentally also provides a precedent for the discussion about the cyberflight management issue that we were deliberating about earlier. But it may be that that type of approach in the form of a policy or a best practice to complement the language that exists in the current UDRP might be a useful way forward on this issue.
I think that's great. You know, you'd have to get that in your panelists' hands too, right? So, yeah, I think that's great, David. Thank you.
Okay, Phil.
Just a clarifying statement on the subject of general UDRP reform. I believe I'm correctly stating what the status is at December, following the receipt of the state of the UDRP report, and there was intense debate about whether or not some form, either substantive or at least procedural UDRP reform should be initiated, with intense resistance from intellectual property interests. I'm not quite sure why, except they were very focused at the time on trying to convert the URS, the new URS, into a very low-cost, faster version of the UDRP by reducing the burden of proof and providing a domain transfer option, et cetera. That fortunately, because of efforts of persons like myself and many others resisting it, did not go forward. But the official status is that in December 2011, the GNNSO Council voted, when they allowed this report to go forward, said that UDRP would not commence. Now, it's not required to commence, but it will not commence until 18 months at a minimum after the introduction of the first new TLD, which, if I can, is on track for the first one to be introduced in the third quarter of this year, would mean that the first UDRP reform could not commence if the GNSO Council sticks to that position until the first quarter of 2015. It doesn't say it will. We don't know what various constituencies will say about commencing it in 2015. And given the importance of the subject and the complexity of the subject, I would expect that if it does commence in early 2015, we would not have recommendations for the community to consider until mid-2016 at the earliest, because of the importance and complexity. So I think just to clarify when that might happen and how much time it might take, that's kind of the status quo right now.
Thank you, Phil. Marika, and then we're going to have to close this.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just one addition to what Phil said, because indeed the council will at that point decide whether not to initiate, but what will be delivered at that point is an issue report by staff. I think we have already committed to that, and or that is a decision by the council that was taken indeed at that time back, but that would then identify indeed all the issues, including all the other RPMs, and at that point indeed the council decides whether or not to proceed or not. But again, it doesn't preclude if any other issues are raised at a council level, should the council now decide to initiate a PDP or address issues, that avenue still remains open. I just want to clarify that as well, that if there are any specific issues that are raised, that can always come up to the council level, and if they decide to request an issue report, initiate a PDP, that course of action is always available to the council.
Right, thank you, Marika. As we're pretty much finished here, thanks for everyone who came. This was the Super Duper UDRP Locket Working Group meeting. For any of you who sat through this and didn't give us any feedback, don't be shy. There's a public comment open at the moment. If you need to speak to anybody who's involved with this, try grabbing me or one of the other members of the working group, or of course Marika. And if thanks everyone. Stop the recording, I suppose. Thank you.